Vayichi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim 17 shana. Vayichi yemei Yaakov shnei chayov 7 shanim v'arba'im uma'as shana. Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. Remember when he was introduced to Paro when he first came down, he told him he was 130. So he lived there 17 years. The total number of years of his life were 7 and 40 and 100 years, also known as 147 years. So let's do a dot, 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 and read the words to the opening music, part of Yaakov's blessing to his grandchildren, and part of our blessings to our children and grandchildren as well. The actual blessing of Yisimcha Elokim Kefraim V'chim Nashe is also from this Sedra, but specifically the Hamalach HaGoel I wanted to read in Ta'amei HaMikra. Hamalach HaGoel Osi Mikol Ra Yivarech es hanarim v'yikorei v'hem shimi v'shem avosai Avraham v'yitzchak v'yidgul arov bekerev ha'aretz. Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. Yes, I am your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Vayechi. But we will be also concentrating on the calendar event, which is Asara B'Tevet tomorrow, the 9th of Tevet today, the 8th of Tevet yesterday, and we'll put it all together. So, recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 9th day of Tevet, 5774, corresponding to December 12th. I missed yesterday's special event. Here in Israel, they were talking about 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, meaning the 11th day of the 12-month December of the year 2013, and the time of 14, 15 is a quarter after 2 in the afternoon. There were people who actually looked at their watches at that moment, and they had the thrill of seeing exactly the instant that it was 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, but I missed it, and I'm not really sorry. Now, the broadcasting today is being done from my auxiliary studio, also known as my home, rather than at my major studio, which is my office at the Israel Center. And that is because we had a decent amount of snow this morning, and public transportation ground to a halt, and schools were closed, and roads were difficult to travel on, and the walking was treacherous. I did a lot of local deliveries of Torah tidbits, but we have a tremendous supply that hasn't been able to get out to its usual distribution points and recipients, but that's neither here nor there at this moment. Using my laptop, I'm using a new headphone that I just bought for the occasion, and we'll see if it works. I'm hoping for the best. Okay, so where are we? Let's say Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot Mima Amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shimava Koli Tihiena Aznecha Kashuvot Lakol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmorya Adonai Mia Amod Ki Imacha Hasalicha Lama'an Tivare. Kiviti Adonai Kivata Nafshi Velidvaro Hochalti. Nafshi Ladonai Mishomerim Laboker Shomerim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai Hachesed Vaharbe Imo Fedut. Vehu Yifde et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, viyotziyem mitzara lirvacha, umiafela leora, umishibud legu'ula, hashtar ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Now, I know that there are listeners in the New York area and elsewhere who have had their snow this week, but Yerushalayim is not a big snow city, and when we get a nice heavy snowfall, as we had, it's sort of nostalgic and exciting for Olim from those parts of the world where snow was a common feature in their winters. Here it's every couple of winters, a little bit of snow. One time, back about 20 years ago, there was a tremendous, tremendous snowstorm, and that was extremely nostalgic. But you roam around the streets during a snowstorm like this, and you see kids improvising, making snowmen, trying to make snowballs, although they really don't know how to do it well. And as an American, you have to teach them how to pack a snowball. The sledding is interesting. Nobody that I've seen has an actual sled, but they improvise. Whenever there's a snow-covered piece of a hill, you'll find kids sliding down either with large plastic garbage bags called snowbagging, and they just sit onto the bag, hold the edges up in their hands, and slide down and have a lot of fun that way. I saw two other methods of improvising. One was the use of a swimming ring, inflated, and kid was sitting in, sliding down the slope. And then I saw three siblings, I think it was two boys and a girl, who each had a cookie baking sheet, aluminum cookie baking sheet, and they were sitting on those and sliding down. So people have their fun. Several snowmen in the neighborhood with a traditional carrot nose, and I think I saw them using radishes for buttons and eyes. So it brings back a little, but it was mixed with rain, and different places in the country had more snow, had less snow, had rain, had no rain. The country, as small as it is, has a lot of different climates all over the place, and you know, the people of the non-snow area sort of are a little jealous of us in Yerushalayim, and sometimes vice versa. So that's the story, and let's proceed. Okay, let me give you the quick background and the tour. There are six public fast days in the Jewish calendar. One is from the Torah. It's called Yom Kippur. Four are related to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and they come from the Navi, and they are Tisha B'Av, Shivasar B'Tammuz, Tzom Gedalia, and Asara B'Tevet. The sixth one is Midivrei Kabbalah, it's called, and that is Ta'anit Esther. Those are the official 6 days. We can add, just in parentheses for the interest, the Fast of the Firstborns, which is by no means in the same league with the others, but it allows me to make the following statement. All fast days, except for one, can fall on Shabbat. When they do, in the case of Yom Kippur, we fast, and in the case of Tisha B'Av, Shivasar B'Tammuz, and Tzom Gedalia, the fast is postponed till Sunday. In the case of Ta'anit Esther, the fast is preponed, pulled back to Thursday, when it would be Shabbat. To postpone Ta'anit Esther doesn't make any sense, because it would be right into Purim or Shushan Purim, and you can't fast on those days, and the day after would be not the point of the fast of Esther. So it has to be before Purim, and therefore it's pulled back. All the other fasts, which are associated with tragedy, are postponed, because you don't bring a commemoration of a tragedy earlier. You always postpone it if you can. That leaves one fast day, that is the 10th of Tevet, which can never fall on Shabbat in our fixed calendar, but more interestingly, it is the only fast day, including Yom Kippur, the only fast day that can fall on Friday, and it does tomorrow. tomorrow, assuming you're listening to me on Thursday. If you're listening to me on Friday, then it's today. If you're listening to me after tomorrow, then it was the day before yesterday or whatever. In any event, it's the only fast day that can fall on Friday. It happens approximately 20% of the time, 20.1% of the time, a little more accurate. The last time it happened was 3 years ago, but it hadn't happened since 10 years before that. So people, every time they come across a 10th of Tevet on a Friday, scratch and they said, wow, this must be rare. I can't remember it ever happening. Well, it just so happens that it was 3 years ago, and 20% occurrence is not the rarest kind of thing that we have on the calendar, and that's the story. So what it means is going into Shabbat fasting, which is not the best thing, but we have no choice because the Navi speaks of this particular fast and uses the phrase Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh on this specific day, indicating, like Yom Kippur, that it's pointed to that particular date, the 10th of Tevet, and it's not moved. What would happen if it fell on Shabbat is a moot point because it doesn't fall on Shabbat. But when it falls on Friday, it does encroach a little bit into Shabbat. Except that Shabbat gets its licks in, and that is that at the mincha of the fast of the 10th of Tevet, we don't say Avinu Malkeinu, and we don't say Tachanun, because it is right before Shabbat. So there's a little clash between the two, and each draws blood from the other, so to speak. I did see in a sefer, and I hope to make this point in my shul tomorrow night, that you do not unnecessarily delay the davening for Kabbalat Shabbat and Arvit, not with a speech and not with any other form of delay, for two reasons. One reason is Kavod HaBriot, the respect for the people who are fasting, who would like to get home and make Kiddush and eat a meal. So you drag it out more than is necessary, and that's not fair to anyone who is fasting. The other thing is that it's not fair to Shabbat to prolong the davening, because the longer the davening, the later you get to Kiddush, the more of Shabbat has been in fasting also. And that's not kavod for Shabbat. Shabbat is eating meals, shalosh su'udot, with the single exception of Yom Kippur Avoni, as we sing in the song, and the only time that Shabbat is supposed to be inconvenienced, so to speak, by fasting is Yom Kippur. On the other hand, I just realized that when Tisha B'Av is Motzoi Shabbat, right after Shabbat, then it does encroach a little bit on Shabbat because we have to stop eating from sunset, even though it's still Shabbat, until stars come out and you could really begin Tisha B'Av. So anyway, that's the overview and the story. More importantly, I would like to focus on what is Asara B'Tevet for. Now, I know I'm running a risk of having people listening to this after the fact, and I usually don't like to do that, but there's something to be learned, even if it's in the context of what was that fast day about in the first place. So it goes like this. Its original commemoration was the beginning of the siege of the Babylonian army headed by Nebuchadnezzar around Jerusalem prior to the destruction of the first temple. The siege lasted 2.5 years, and the breach of Jerusalem occurred on the 9th of Tammuz, and 3 weeks plus later on the 9th of Av, that's like 4 weeks later, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. In the second temple, the breach was on the 17th of Tammuz, and that's why we celebrate. That's why we commemorate and mark Shivasar B'Tammuz, not the 9th. And our sages didn't want to pile on additional fast days, so they sort of moved the commemoration of the breach of Jerusalem in the first temple to the same date as the second one. The destruction of both temples was, according to our tradition, on the 9th of Av, the 9th and 10th of Av. So what you have in Asar B'Tevet is the beginning of the Churban, the destruction, the beginning of the siege, and then Shivasar B'Tammuz, representing the breach of Jerusalem, is the next phase. Destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is the next phase, and the primary one, and that's why Tisha B'Av is a more substantial fast than the others. And then the culmination of this set of four fast days is Tzom Gedalia, the third of Tishrei, which marks the conclusion of the Churban, in based on the story that there was a remnant of Jews still in Yerushalayim even after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. They were actually given autonomy, and their governor was Gedalia ben Achikam, and he was assassinated in a plot hatched by some of his relatives who were trying to take over the position, or something like that. And that gave the Babylonians an excuse to slaughter more Jews, exile the rest, and the way the Rambam describes it, the glowing ember of the Jewish presence, even after the destruction, was extinguished on Tzom Gedalia. So it's a set of fast days, and the bright side of that set is the promise that we have by the Navi, a prophecy that these four fast days will become Yamim Tovim, festive days, in the future, which we consider to be the building of the third Beit HaMikdash in the Messianic era. So, Asara B'Tevet is a sad and mournful day now, as are the others, with the exception, by the way, of Tanit Esther, which is not a sad day. It's a serious day. That's a whole other story. We'll get to that when Purim comes around, Amir Tzashem. But as far as Asara B'Tevet, it is currently a black day. Now, there are two other events that are associated with the 10th of Tevet, one that is associated more specifically with the 8th of Tevet, and which was yesterday, and the other the 9th of Tevet, which is today. Again, depending on when you're listening, you have to change those descriptions. And instead of making three fast days in a row, which sages wouldn't do to us, they combined the commemorations into that of Asara B'Tevet. So you have the event of the 8th of Tevet is known as the Targum Shivim, the translation into Greek of the Torah. First time it was taken from us in that form and translated into a foreign language. It was done by force. The story goes that the Greek-Egyptian king Ptolemy ordered the translation by 70 scholars who were separated from each other and were commanded to translate the Torah into Greek. And our sources record a miracle that occurred, that there were 18 cosmetic changes that were made in the translation so that gross misunderstanding would not come about. And each one of these scholars had the insight to do those same 18 changes. But still, it's considered a black day, equivalent to the day of the sinning of the golden calf. And the fact that there was a miracle, that there were 18 changes that were made in the way the translation goes, does not really point in the other direction, that there are not just 18, but thousands of problems in translation. You translate something, it loses a lot in translation, as the expression goes. More to the point, the non-Jewish world in general, that then took the Greek and rendered it into Latin and into every language known to civilization, and to the point where the Torah, the Bible, is the all-time bestseller of the history of books. And yet, we take it as a tragedy because the world took the written word and translated it, or had it translated, and left the entire body of oral law and Torah out of the picture, which we believe is a completely inseparable part of Torah. You can't understand Torah without the oral Torah. The written word does not do it by itself. And there are many, many, many examples to this. Let me give you one. Okay, if you just heard me offering an example, I don't know what happened to the example that I gave, but I think I lost about 2 minutes. So we're going to do them again. It goes like this. Simple example. There are many. Take the tip of your index finger, your pointer, and put it between your eyes. Most people, when I ask them to do that, will put their tip of their finger on the bridge of their nose, which is right between their eyes. And that is correct anatomically, but it is wrong in the Torah context. The Torah tells us to put our tefillin, to bind it on the arm, and to place the totafot bein einecha, between your eyes. A person who puts the tefillin on the bridge of his nose is not fulfilling the mitzvah correctly. It's as if he didn't do the mitzvah at all, because that is not what the Torah means when it says between your eyes. Now, there are people, and this is the whole point of the non-Jewish world and even among the Jewish people, who say, what are you talking about? I have the Bible. And I turn to the place, Deuteronomy 4, whatever, and there it says, between your eyes. Now, even look at the Hebrew, it says, bein einecha. Not what the Torah means. There's where the oral law comes in. The oral law teaches us that bein einecha means on your head, towards the front, up to the hairline. That is the former hairline, the original hairline. Otherwise, we'd have to keep moving it back in some cases. And that's where the tefillin goes. What it's doing there are beautiful explanations for it and what it means, and that's not the point. The point is, without the oral law, the Torah is perverted. Hold that thought. We'll give you more examples in a moment. You're listening to Torah Tibbetz Audio for Parshat Vayechi. I haven't mentioned much about the Parsha yet, and I don't know when I'll get there, but I still want to continue on. We're on up to the 8th of Tevet, and then I want to move on briefly to the 9th. We already spoke about the 10th, and then we have to add one more dimension to Aser B'Tevet before we can move on to the Parsha. And no opening music. Taking a much longer time than I usually do. My conditions are not as great in my auxiliary studio, but I think it's coming out okay. New headphones, and we'll see if they work even better than the ones that I use in the office. Okay, we were talking about examples of the inability to understand Torah without the oral law, which is the tragedy of the Targum Shivim and all the translations since then. It's very, very difficult to translate the words of the Torah. You have your gross examples, for example, an eye for an eye. An eye for an eye has been the cause of the Jewish people, being accused of being a barbaric nation, whose Bible tells us to pluck out someone's eye if he caused an injury to another person's eye, which is not what it means. Yeah, but it's what it says. That's the problem. It's not what it says, it's what it means. Now, I have to emphasize this, and I have on many, many shows in the past, and in writing in Torah Tibbetz as well, and it's a point that I can't make enough times. We believe, we believe not only that God exists and that he created the world and he gave the Torah at Sinai to the Jewish people. But at that act of revelation at Sinai and the 40 days that followed it, there was a giving of the Torah by God to Moshe Rabbeinu to transmit to the Jewish people and then future generations throughout all time. The Torah, what it says, and what it means. What it means is what you can call the oral Torah or the oral law. And there are many examples where the pshat, the plain meaning of the words, do not do the job of explaining what it is without the oral law. You might ask, so why? Why not spell it out in writing? There are many answers to it, one of which is that if you fix something in writing, it often gets outdated the moment it's published. And if you have an oral component to it, which requires understanding and explanation, then it remains a living Torah, a living body of law. But that's only one aspect of Torah Sheba'al Peh. There was also perhaps the aspect that this is the way God wanted it to be. He wanted it to be cryptic and often misleading if you insist on the written word only, because he wanted that trust, confidence, faith, belief in the oral Torah. We believe, and there are indications in the Torah itself, meaning in the written word, that there is such a thing as an oral law. It shows up in many examples. One that comes off the top of my head is the laws of Shechita, the laws of ritual slaughter. God says, aside from korbanot, sacrifices in the temple, if you happen to want to eat meat, then you have to slaughter the animal as I have commanded you. So, there's your starting point. You flip the pages back and forth in the Torah. You read your five books of Moses in the Bible from cover to cover, and you see where it says that you have to slaughter the animal as I have commanded you, and you don't see the details. You don't see that it's with a knife to the neck, to the carotid artery and the windpipe and the food pipe, the esophagus and the trachea, primary simanim, but the carotid artery and the jugular vein gets cut also, and all the details of Shechita, as I commanded you, says God. Where are they? The answer is they are in the oral law, which God gave to Moshe orally to transmit to the people orally, to understand what the Torah means when it says things. Not to belabor the point, but let me give one more example. The Torah has an issue of brothers who live together. Exactly why it says that, I'm not sure. Have to look it up. But the issue is one brother dies without children, without issue, without whatever. We'll talk about that in a second. And his wife and his brother have an attachment known as zikuk liyibum, which either is consummated as a marriage, a levirate marriage it's called, yibum, or it is the relationship is severed by a divorce-like process called chalitza. Now the Torah says, if a man dies, uven ein lo, and he had no ben. What's a ben? I know, a ben is a son. Wait a minute, I think a ben is a child. Well, a son is a ben, a daughter is a bat. The inclusive term for child would be ben, because that's the way the grammar works, which means words like ben, and many, many, many other words in Hebrew, are exclusive or inclusive depending on which one is meant to be. The word yom, day, could mean day as opposed to night. That would be exclusive. It could be inclusive and refer to a 24-hour period. And we'll get there in a moment also. Let's go back to the sun. So the Torah says if a man dies and has no ben, then this relationship happens between his wife. Picture in your mind a village, a Jewish village in ancient Israel, which had a Torah, the written word, and did not have anyone learned or schooled in the oral law. Or whatever. They said it's what it says, and that's what we go by. First test case they ever had. A guy died, young fellow in an accident, survived by a daughter, his wife, and a daughter. And the case comes before the tribunal in this town of elders. And they discuss the issue. They said, look what the Torah says. It says if a person dies and he has no ben, son, then his wife is to be married to his brother. And the first child that they have is named for the deceased. And his name shall not be cut off and erased from Israel. Logic that one of the elders is proposing is that a girl doesn't carry the name of the father. A son can. And therefore, when the Torah says a man dies uven ein lo, it was referring to a son. The fact that he has a daughter is irrelevant. Another one gets up and argues, how do we know it's exclusive when the word is ben? Maybe it's inclusive and it means child. Now, halachically, Jewish law, based on the written word and the oral Torah, is that if a man has any descent, a son, a daughter, a grandson, a granddaughter alive, there is no yibum. That means that if this little village tribunal of elders were to allow the marriage, in fact encourage the marriage between the deceased's brother and his widow, they would be condoning an incestuous relationship which carries with it a penalty of death. A brother-in-law, sister-in-law in this way cannot marry, with the single exception of the mitzvah of Yibum. And therefore it is extremely urgent to know what the Torah means when it says Uvein Ein Lo. I mentioned the word Yom, that also we have a circumcision at night is not valid because the Torah says Uvayom Hashmini, on the eighth day he shall be circumcised. And we take the word Yom, we are taught that the word Yom there is exclusive. Then you have Zachorat Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, remember the Shabbat today and make it holy. And there the Yom refers to a 24-hour period. In fact, the mitzvah of Zachorat Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho is to make Kiddush Friday night and to make Kiddush and to say Havdalah when Shabbat ends. So it's a very important thing to combine the written word with the oral law. Otherwise, we get distortion and perversion, or at least question mark, as to what the Torah means. Okay, as you have figured out, it's a topic I get very passionate about, and I have a lot more to say, but let's move on. The 9th of Tevet is the Yortzeitz, the anniversary of the death of the two giants who brought the Jewish people, unfortunately in small number, back to the land of Israel after the first exile to Babylonia, and led to the building of the second Beit HaMikdash, Ezra and Nehemiah. Basically, they restored the Jewish people to the land of Israel and restored the Torah to those people who had distanced themselves from Torah, and Ezra basically filled the role of another Moshe Rabbeinu, another Moses, in bringing the Torah to these people and to renew the commitment to Torah. And it was a difficult thing. His death and the death of Nehemiah, who was the prophet at the time, instrumental in setting up the Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash, their deaths had a very significant impact on the people in a very sad way, and they felt very distraught by it, and to the point where it combines to the commemoration of Asara B'Tevet as well. And all of these things are mentioned in the Slichot that are said in the morning, and we should keep them in our minds during this fast day. I also would like to mention that whether or not a person fasts, with good excuse or not, to not fast, it's still a fast day, and it's still a mournful day, and it's still a day for pondering and contemplating and meditating on the tragedies of Jewish history, with the hope that we will break out of the cycles that we have been swallowed up in over these many, many centuries, and move on towards the Geula Shlema. So that's part of the agenda of a fast day as well. The other item was added in modern Israel by the Knesset, and that is a Holocaust Memorial Day in the form that is called Yom Kaddish Klali. A Yom Kaddish Klali is a day that was designated for the saying of Kaddish for those who perished in the Holocaust, but we have no idea when they died. If a person knows when, then that date is observed as a Yahrzeit. But there are many, many, many countless people whose date of death we do not know. And this is the day designated for that aspect of Holocaust Memorial. So it even adds a modern punch to the day, and it's a very important day as is. One more thought on the Kaddish thing. In addition to not knowing when a person died in the Shoah, there are millions of Jews whose identities are not known either. In other words, when you know someone who says, my grandfather's brother died in the Shoah, or whatever, the existence of known victims of the Shoah is probably equaled by the existence of unknown victims of the Shoah. So we have people, not only do we not know when they died, we don't even know their names. And therefore, it is fitting for the Jewish people to accept upon themselves the marking of a Yahrzeit for victims of the Shoah who nobody says Kaddish for. And that's why there are many, many people who say Kaddish on Asara B'Tevet, even if they are not personally saying Kaddish for a specific individual. So all that said, it's a serious kind of day. It's tomorrow, as of this moment that I am speaking. And it's a Friday fast day. It's a short day. The fast begins at dawn, which in Yerushalayim is 5:12, and ends at 5:06, which is the fast ending Tzeta Kochavim, stars out. Yet we have to wait after 5:06 until we get to Kiddush and Hamotzi and our Shabbat meal, so it'll be a little bit longer than that. But that's the story. Anyone who can't hold out till Kiddush is still fasting at 5:06 can at least drink some water to tide him over for till Kiddush. And now we spend a little time on Parshat Vayechi. Vayechi is the 12th and final weekly portion of the book of Bereshit. It finishes the book of Bereshit. It happens to be the smallest of the 12 Sedras in Bereshit, and it starts out, oh, let's say, on an upbeat note, with a little bit of down, and that is that Yaakov has lived in Egypt 17 years, during which time the family has thrived, and the brothers have been together, and Torah was learned, and Yosef took care of his father and his brothers, and it should be moving towards and they lived happily ever after. But it doesn't. The one negative note there, which is sort of sticks out of the Parsha, is that he lived in Egypt. And Yaakov Avinu was not supposed to live in Egypt. Yaakov Avinu was supposed to live in Eretz Megurei Aviv, in Eretz Canaan, the land which was to become Eretz Yisrael. So already we find that Yaakov had his childhood and early youth in Eretz Yisrael. He had a long period of time in Lavan's territory, came back to Eretz Yisrael, had problems for many years, most notably Yosef, and then ended up spending the last 17 years of his life in Egypt. Now, obviously, that's not where he wanted to be, proof of which is he calls to Yosef when Yaakov was on his deathbed and says to him, "Al na tikbereini b'Mitzrayim, please don't bury me in Egypt. And swear to me that you won't bury me in Egypt. And I know that you're probably upset that I didn't bury your mother, Rachel, in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, the place where Avraham is buried, and Sarah Imenu, and Yitzchak and Rivka, and that I, Yaakov, buried Leah, and not your mother, Rachel. Nonetheless, I ask you, and I ask you to swear to it, not to bury me in Mitzrayim." And Yosef swears, and a piece of Vayechi is a description of the funeral procession to of Yaakov, and the large entourage, not only of his family, but of Egypt as well, who went up to Canaan in order to be at the burial. So, okay, before Yaakov dies, he gives blessings to Yosef, to Yosef's children, to the tribes. That's a whole analysis by itself, which we don't have time for now, because some of it was critical of the sons, of some of the sons, and yet there is blessing couched within the criticism, or criticism rather within the blessing, and others are more expansive kind of blessing. But we sense, except for the fact that they're in Egypt, that they have succeeded, survived, flourished. That was the end of Vayigash, which tells us that they grew into a large multitude of people. And we're still looking towards that happily ever after, which is not to be. Because as soon as Yaakov dies, the brothers come to Yosef, and they're scared. They assumed that he Yosef, was biding his time until the until Yaakov, their father, would die, and then Yosef would have his revenge and retribution against the brothers for what they did. They did terrible thing to him. And yet it was not to be. Yosef said, "What do you think, I'm instead of God? This was God's plan, and I'm not going to do anything to you. You're my brothers." And still, even when the Torah is telling us that Yosef lived to raise his great-grandchildren on his knees, even that generation, happy times, but not so happy. Yaakov dies, Yosef dies, the brothers die. That's how Shemot next week starts. And the people are all, not just Yaakov and his sons, but all the people, the multitude of people, are in Egypt until the deaths of the sons. The last one to die was Levi, who lived 137 years. Until his death, there was no enslavement, but shortly thereafter it started. So, and maybe more than that, you know, enslavement to Paro, so you're redeemed and you're free. And we celebrate Pesach, and we celebrate a lot of things, Zecher Liyitziat Mitzrayim. But the enmity that the brothers felt towards Yosef, even though they were reconciled with him, continues to go into future generations. And that's why last week you had the Haftorah about Yechezkel Hanavi being told to take two sticks, and one to write the word Yehuda, and another the word Ephraim, because these were the kingdom, the two kingdoms that split after Shlomo HaMelech's reign, and 10 tribes got lost, and the concept, which I've spoken about recently, so I'm not going to belabor that point, is over and over again, problems among the Jewish people, brother to brother. So we don't have that happily ever after yet, but we have an agenda. That agenda includes behaving in such a way that the causes of the Beit HaMikdash destruction won't exist with us anymore, the enmity of brother against brother won't exist anymore, and the stage will be set for the restoration of Torah to the Jewish people to Eretz Yisrael, and we will live happily ever after. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.